Okay. Good morning, everyone. The July 27, 2021 HRSD Commission meeting will now come to order in person. So we will now have a roll call. HRSD Commission members, please say here after Ms. Casco calls your name.
Glenn.
Here.
Lackawalla.
Yes.
Robinson.
Here.
Taroski.
Here.
Ford.
Here.
Rodriguez.
Here.
Ellison.
Here. Thank you.
So the audio of the non-exempt portions of the meeting is being recorded for posting on our website in accordance with FOIA. So please keep your microphone on mute. And before speaking, including when making or seconding a motion, please first state your name. The committee is a public body subject to the Virginia FOIA laws. Members should refrain from direct communication except when in a publicly advertised meeting. Communication should all be routed to Jennifer and distribute information to all members. Only public comments pre-registered with Ms. Casio will be accepted during the call. I understand no one is registered to make public comments at this time. Still okay?
That's correct.
So the first item of the agenda will be awards.
Awards and recognition. And this morning we have someone to recognize. So we've got a promotion to Jill Mergen, who was recently promoted to the Chief of Customer Care. And Jill has been with us for since 2013. And she's been working in this field of public service prior to this with Chesapeake. So about 22 years of experience now, Jill. And she's a graduate of Old Dominion, Dr. Lackawalla, yes, and just recently completed her MBA at William & Mary. So she's going to bring a lot of talent and energy to this position. It was made possible by the former chief moving over to help Jay out with some compliance issues and put her talents, her CPA talents and others, to work on compliance, opening this opportunity for Jill. So it's a great win all the way around for the organization. And Jill, welcome.
Hi there. Would you like to make any comment? Well, congratulations. Okay, and we'll move on to the consent agenda.
Consent agenda is a package. Staff's not aware of anything that any members asked to have removed. But we're here to answer whatever questions.
Hearing any, need a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Any names?
Steve Rodriguez.
Flynn, second.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. I roll call.
Flynn?
Yes.
Lackawalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Taroski?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ellison?
Yes.
Thank you.
Item three.
I know. Yes, that's the nice thing about being in person.
It's nice you don't have to unmute yourself.
Everybody's happy not to have to deal with it. So item three is Eastern Shore Infrastructure Improvements Transmission Force Main Phase 1. So three actions on this morning. One is to appropriate additional funding in the amount of $3,643,040. Approve a comprehensive agreement with Garney Companies Incorporated, including a contract cost limit, CCL, of $15,764,700, and approve a task order with HPR Engineering amount of $204,000. So this is our transmission force main on the Eastern Shore from Massawattox to Nancock. Really the first key element of our regionalization of wastewater facilities there. And this is, we have great bids, or actually it's design build, but really good proposals type group. And the final dollar value was really in line with what we thought we were gonna be paying. Garney, we haven't done any work with in a long time, but if you look them up, they're headquartered in Kansas City, but they do just water and wastewater work across the country. They've done, I think they advertise that they've done the largest design build water project in the country, but they do a wide variety. And so this is probably on the small end, but I think they're looking to become more familiar with HRSD as we continue to build big SWIFT projects going forward. So we expect this to be a really good project. Do anticipate we'll probably have some sort of groundbreaking this fall ceremonial over on the Eastern Shore to really set the stage. This is really the first piece of Easter.
Is that an overnight trip to get over there?
I don't know, ask Charles. He'll put you up.
Probably overnight to come back. Go ahead, sir. All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lockwalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Tarosky?
Yes.
Ward?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ulison?
Yes.
Thank you.
Item four.
Item four is a high-risk clamp replacement program. This is the initial appropriation for the CIP project. We're asking for $455,000. So this is the first phase of a repair project. It's really been driven by our asset management group. They've looked at the likelihood of failure and greatest consequence of failure for areas where we've got known clamps on some of our pipes. Chairman had asked what those look like. This is really what a new clamp looks like, the one on the right. And the left is what the existing clamps that we have found in many locations. So you see the bolts are deteriorating, and when they finally go away, the clamp kind of opens up and they have pipe failure. So there's a number of these in the system throughout, and the idea is to go find the ones that have the highest risk and consequence of failure and get those done first. And so that's what this project is to start with. We'll see more of these coming in the future with this stuff. And again, it's pretty complicated. You gotta dig down the pipe, you gotta expose it, and then you gotta get it open. Replace the plant.
How did they find the spot?
These are all from our as-built drawings, which are pretty accurate. I mean, when you think of as-built drawings for most organizations, they probably are nowhere near as accurate as ours, but we've got pretty good records of where these plants were installed, soil conditions, and areas where we think they are most likely to need to be replaced.
How long ago were these clamps?
It ranges. Some of the clamps were installed when the pipe was installed initially, and then others are repairs to a pipe that's damaged. They use a clamp on either side. So it could have been done when the pipe was originally installed, and this pipe was, this one that failed was back in the late 70s. Or there could have been a repair that was done 10 or 15 years ago by us or by a contractor, and then those corroded bolts failed. Mm-hmm. So it varies with time, and the more corrosive the soil, the faster the bolts fail. So they might last 50 years, they might last 5 years. They're not protected.
Stainless steel bolt, correct.
Now we're using different, either epoxy coated or stainless, depending on
the often the bolts weren't.
That's what
the clamp could be, but the bolts weren't. That's what we found that many days.
Let me get into the weeds a little bit more, just because I'm kind of crazy on this. But when you do your as-builds, most of your as-builds are set up based on the surveyor's baseline, correct? So in the future, should we not be doing something along that GPS?
Oh, it's all in GPS.
Is it now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, very good.
They have to GPS every single stick of pipe so that we make sure we don't get any high spots.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
All right. You move.
Tarosky. Looks over.
Okay. All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
One.
Yes.
Lockwalla.
Yes.
Levinston.
Yes.
Tarosky.
Yes.
Ward.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Ulison.
Yes.
Thank you.
Item five.
Item five is James River Treatment Plant Shoreline Stabilization. So this is a new CIP, and there's three actions. One is to approve the new CIP for the James River Treatment Plant Shoreline Stabilization, appropriate the total project funding in the amount of $2,136,000, and to approve a task order with VHB in the amount of $243,790. The reason this is a new one, we've pulled this out of the existing CIP that was already there for the James River work. And we need to accelerate the work we're doing on the shoreline because we're losing shoreline to the point where it's threatening our James River facilities. What we've added here is some work on some New Pernice property as well, and we anticipate a cost share agreement in the future from them for that work. But while you're mobilizing this kind of construction for shoreline work, just makes sense to do everything that's in the same general area. So this is pretty critical to the rest of our James River work. Here's the map. So the shoreline erosion is down here at the bottom, but you know, we're building this yellow trail, and until we get the shoreline finished, can't really build the trail. And then the city's portion that's eroding is over in this area where this beach is. They're also having some shoreline issues as well. So we'll be taking care of our shoreline in this area and the city's shoreline.
And how much of that is hard, the 600 million?
Just really in this, of the existing, none of it's hard now. I don't know that we got a design yet on the city portion. Ours is going to be a combination of the offshore breakwater and hardening of the actual shore. But I don't think we've got it. We haven't got the design yet. Unfortunately, with the wave action there and across the James, a lot of it has to be hardened. We can't just live with a living shoreline as much as it would be nice. It's too much exposure and fetch across the river.
Now, how much is that going to delay our project? Waiting on?
It's not. That's why we're doing this one now. We're ready to get this design and get this bid now. So this one's moving pretty quickly.
Need a motion. Button for approval.
Thank you.
That was the second.
Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Flynn?
Yes.
Dr. Walla?
Yes.
Levinson?
Yes.
Tarosky?
Yes.
Ford?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Eelson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Item six.
Item six is the Washington District Pump Station replacement. This is another carved out CIP that's become a new CIP. And so today we're asking for approval of the CIP and the initial appropriation. This is the CIP to replace the Washington District Pump Station and appropriate total project funding out of $9,400,000. So we had a CIP in the CIP program for Dozier's Corner and Washington District where we're going to do some flood mitigation. As we got into the preliminary design work, it really looked like that was not going to be a good use of our funds because we still weren't going to solve the flooding issues that were going to happen. And really, both stations are old. And it looks like a better course of action is to really replace both stations. So we broke them into two separate CIPs from the original single CIP. And this is just for the Washington District Pump Station. And we will replace it at an elevation where it won't be subject to sea level rise in the near term. And we show you the vicinity map. So if you travel down 64 towards a high rise, or 64 towards a high rise bridge, we sit over here in the low area, city of Chesapeake, right in that area. The Washington District Pump Station. The Dozier's Corner one is back over here, and that will be coming to you with a separate CIP for replacement of that. You're going to hear a little bit more about this pipe section here in a future agenda item.
I'll say, are we still working with the Dominion?
Yep, you'll see that one coming up here just shortly. So.
They already approved it. They already approved.
That was in the consent agenda. That's right. Thank you.
Motion.
Rodriguez motion to approve.
Glenn second.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. Our roll call.
Glenn.
Yes.
Lockdawalla.
Yes.
Levinston.
Yes.
Tarosky.
Yes.
Ward.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Eelson.
Yes.
Item seven
is the West Road Interceptor Force Main Extension. This is an initial appropriation and authorizing me to sign a letter of intent for a cost sharing agreement. So this is a little unusual. Normally we'd have a cost sharing agreement for you, but Chesapeake doesn't want to move forward without us saying that I'm authorized to sign the cost sharing agreement. They also want us to have the money in our pocket. So we're making both these things before we actually get the cost sharing agreement. So the appropriation is for $8,452,148. That's for our total cost for this. The good news is Chesapeake's going to do this work under their contract. So West Road is a very small country road extending southerly. And here's a map. So the yellow is this little piece on West Road that we're building. It looks little. It's actually more than a mile, almost 2 miles. This is the first phase of extending sewer service potentially all the way down towards the lower end where they've got the Williams Farm development that's potentially going to be a big development in the city of Chesapeake, and they may want to bring sewer all the way here. That's the airport. So this is extending a sewer line down here. The city's bringing their water line down at the same time. That's why they're going to put our sewer line in with their water line project. Total project's about $24 million, and we're about a third of that. Sorry, $8 million. The city will be taking care of all of that. We take care of this screen problem. So I think this is, again, a great cooperative effort between us and the city of Chesapeake to get the extension of service down towards the southern part of Chesapeake. Again, they're very cautious about extending services down that direction. They don't want to spur a massive development in the southern part of Chesapeake. So this takes a lot of everything that's done down here is council action directed, very carefully controlled from Chesapeake's end. So in fact, they're bringing water and sewer just to that little direction that we showed. It is a big step, but that serves some existing facilities that are in that area that need service.
Motion to approve, Rodriguez.
Thank you. Taroski, second. Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Blunt.
Yes.
Lakkawala.
Yes.
Levinson.
Yes.
Taroski.
Yes.
Ward.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Elison.
Yes.
Thank you.
Item eight.
This is the large pond area sanitary sewer improvements. Since this is an acquisition of real property at 5406 Powhatan for a pump station. So if you recall, this Larchmont area project is a work a partnership between us and the city of Norfolk to basically replace five of our stations and two of theirs, maybe. So these are all very small stations that were built as part of our original idea of intercepting sewer. So Larchmont had straight pipe sewer in many places back in the 40s when they were first built. And so they took the waste away from the homes, took it down to the end of the street, dumped it into the Lafayette River, and Elizabeth River on the other side. And so we built these little pump stations to collect those, intercept those before they went in, and pumped them back into the system, basically, to get them to our treatment plants. Well, so we've got this weird arrangement of these small stations in these very flood-prone neighborhoods in Norfolk, Larchmont particularly. And so this will consolidate those, relay a lot of the gravity pipes. Major effort, you see $38 million that Norfolk's contributing to that. Along that, we end up with two instead of five pump stations, but we have to buy property to do that. So this is, we're working closely with the city. Probably not going to hear the end of this when the neighborhood sees that we tear this house down. We've got a willing seller. It's immediately adjacent to our existing pump station. This works out very nicely. So this is our pump station here. This is the house we're acquiring. Look at it, plan view. So we're acquiring this house near the corner of Buckingham and Powhatan. You know, nobody loves pump stations in their backyard. So
it's on a corner.
It is on a corner, but it's the new pump station will be further in, closer to these other properties, but it's really the best place to build it. And again, willing seller, and the city is very cooperative and working with us. But that isn't going to stop the neighbors from potentially raising a ruckus when we get out there. So just want you to be aware. And this is the easy one at Larchmont. So the next one is going to be a lot more challenging, and you'll see that in the coming months.
So will this be a house design?
We're definitely going to design it to try to blend it in the neighborhood and hide it as best we can. Just wanted you to have fair warning that we probably haven't heard the end of this one. I don't know what else we could do. We get accused all the time from public record. We need to put a site in, a pump station or some other facility, tank in the case of others. And we go out and try to find a willing seller so we don't have to condemn any property. We close the deal on the property and then everyone gets upset when we find out what's going on. If you went to the neighbor and said, hey, we need to build a pump station, nobody would come forward, right? So it's this chicken and egg thing of when do you engage the public? And so, and also the price goes way up if they know you're trying to buy one particular piece. So,
well, we already have a pump station.
Yeah, we can't fit it on that same site.
No, but so they're used to seeing one smaller, but
I guarantee you, just won't. I don't think this is going to go over great, but this is still the easier of the two. So, okay. Just beware.
All right. Any other questions? All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. A roll call.
Blunt.
Yes.
Lackawanna.
Yes.
Levinston.
Yes.
Choroski.
Yes.
Ward.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Elosak.
Yes.
Thank you.
Item nine
is also a property acquisition for a pump station, this time in Elizabeth area in Suffolk. So this one's actually going to work out a lot better because we've got an industrial site and a willing seller that we've worked with for some time. Here's the map. You can see that we actually may be one of the better looking things in this stretch once we build our pump station.
Yeah.
So every now and then we can actually become the better part of the neighborhood. So we've worked hard to get this site figured out. And this is part of a dual pump station solution in Suffolk that will take a significant amount of pipe that currently runs through Shingle Creek watershed and take it out of that. We won't need that pipe any longer. We'll pump from either end. So this is really a great benefit for the Shingle Creek and ultimately the Mansman River. We've got a lot of issues with problems in that pipe in the Shingle Creek area.
So is it just a corner lot we're talking about between the street and the railroad?
Yeah, we're actually carved out of this parcel. There goes. It's this carving this and creating this new parcel here.
Where?
So this is the Portsmouth Boulevard. We're creating a new parcel out of these pieces.
So that road shown on a corner parcel going back across the railroad track is not a that looked like it's dedicated. Am I looking at something incorrect here?
No, that's the Virginia Ham Drive. I don't know why it doesn't show on this
survey.
So that lot right there is the one on the picture to the right. Is that correct?
Yeah, so Bruce, can you?
If you look at the Rouse Serene attachment, it's in the package, Ted, it shows the ingress egress, how we're going to get into that property. It's part of the attachment to the commission agenda package.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's it.
Okay.
So here's the Virginia Ham Drive that was shown by Steve right there. So we're going to do ingress egress. Our parcel's up in here.
Okay.
They'll bring that private access Virginia Ham back in this new access.
Okay, any other questions?
Motion.
Roski.
One second. All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
One.
Yes.
Lackawanna.
Yes.
Levinston.
Yes.
Choroski.
Yes.
Ward.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Elosak.
Yes. Item 10.
So our COVID update, surveillance update. I think you've got Kyle in the Ethernet somewhere up there. Kyle, you want me to drive the presentation? I don't remember what you said. I drive. So I'm driving your presentation, Kyle, here locally.
Okay, no problem.
Just tell me when to advance slides and we'll make it work.
Sure. Yeah, we can go ahead and get to the first slide.
Can you see it?
I can see, yes. Thank you.
All
okay.
Good.
Great. So, yeah, thanks for this time. today's update will involve or include data up through last week. We've continued our weekly surveillance of the 9 major facilities, and we'll go over some of the general trends, which may not be super surprising, just given what you've been hearing in terms of caseloads in the area. I want to briefly talk about some of the data that we processed, where we analyzed a number of the variants of concern, and then just a quick overview of a study that I think is really interesting that we're doing with the city of Chesapeake, and is a really good example of kind of the real world application of what we've been doing. So next slide, please. So we had a really good run. The holiday sort of time peak for us with our wastewater load was our sample from 12/29 at the end of last year. So the end of December was when we saw that big peak. Since then, minus about 1 week, we've had basically a steady decline week over week. So like a 26-week run of declining regional viral load, which was recently broken. And so we've seen actually a little bit of an uptick in the last 3 weeks. This map is something that most of you are familiar with, where each of the catchment boundaries is identified in a different color, representing the population normalized viral load. And if you look on the left, you can see going back in time to the third week of June, we were on that decline. And right at the end of June, we actually had 7 plants below our limit of detection. So we were really feeling good then. We thought we were going to go all 9 non-detect. But the beginning of July was actually the first time we saw that resurgence. So detections at all 9 plants there, detections at 7 of the 9 mid-July. And then last week, more detections and viral load kind of up again. And so next slide, please. If we take a look at this figure that we're familiar with, kind of looking at the region, we can see this pretty well. So real big decline basically for all of this year until recently. And then we've added an inset plot here, the smaller plot, to just same exact data as you'll see down there, but just zoomed in so you can see a little bit better what these recent increases in viral load look like. There was the biggest uptick was that first one, and then they've been smaller since then. Not sure if we're seeing an effect of 4th of July weekend. The timing certainly does work out in terms of incubation period and when we would expect to see some increased shedding, but it's always tough to parse, what actually causes these things. So that's kind of what's going on just roughly with our regional viral load and our routine monitoring. Can we do next slide? One thing I wanted to bring to the group is something we've talked about, but it's been a kind of a long process to get the assays to work well and get the data processed. But what we have here is some of the variant data that HRSD has analyzed in our wastewater. And so on the left, we're going to take a look at the concentration of a couple of these variants as compared to the wild type. So just the sort of the standard SARS-CoV-2 assay we've been using. And on the right, what you're looking at is the fractional abundance, which is the proportion of any of the variant strains to the wild type. So you can think of just what's the proportion of any of those variants to the total SARS that we that we measure. And so just one more point of reference on the bottom there, I put the date range. We went back and ran these assays for each of our weekly samples, going back to early February and ending in May, just to see kind of a shot, sort of an educated guess as to when we thought some of these variants might be moving into the area. And then we wanted to see in terms of both concentration in the wastewater and then kind of proportion, what did it look like through early spring, I guess. And so if you look at the left, what you can see, the 4 solid lines, the gray is the Brazil variant, the orange yellow kind of color is the UK, the green is the South African, and these have all been given the alpha, beta, gamma, and then we don't have delta on here nomenclature now. And then the blue is an assay that just describes sort of all variants. So those are the variant concentrations. And just as a point of reference for since we are dealing with concentration, that dashed line that is kind of sharply declining, That's that same regional viral load that you just saw in the previous figure, just dropped on here as a point of reference. And so kind of what you can see is of the variants that we measured, the UK, we saw the UK in the highest concentration. Once it moved in, it did go up for a while, but then it falls off pretty sharply. And so there's a couple interpretations there. One might just be that overall in May, we were still seeing a sharp decline or a steady decline of all SARS CoV-2 in our wastewater. So variants and the wild type. The other is that at some point Delta moved in. And so it's known to become the dominant strain once it gets into an area. And that's another possibility. And that's something that you might see on the, might be a little more clear if that is what's happening on that plot on the right, where you look at it in terms of proportion. And you can see that, yes, once these move into an area, they really do, particularly the UK around here, became dominant. So that axis on the left is 0 to 1, but you can think of it in terms of percent. So when you take a look at the peak of that orange line, the UK variant, when we saw it, it was, you know, probably 0.75 maybe. It was making up a significant proportion of the total SARS-CoV-2 that we were measuring. And then it kind of fell off a cliff, which is a really interesting thing to see in your data. And I went back and checked, and that's not an error in terms of just numbers. So that's an interesting thing that's up for interpretation. I don't know if it really has to do with the Delta variant moving in and just totally becoming dominant or something else is going on, but we will continue to analyze these variant data, but I wanted to share some of the kind of preliminary results with the group now. And then, yeah, we can do next slide, please. Lastly, you know, we'll continue to collaborate. Our relationship with VDH and CDC has only gotten stronger with all of this work that we've been doing. There's a lot of collaboration going on. And one really good example of that right now is this collection system study we're doing for Chesapeake. So with some funding that VDH secured, we've taken weekly samples at 5 pump stations, which I've highlighted here in this map, which are in the city of Chesapeake. And these were selected, and this study was kind of designed by, in a collaboration with Health Department, HRSD, and Chesapeake. These sites were picked based on their vaccination rate data that they have for, at first we were using census tracts, but then we were able to get more specific and use actual pump station catchments. And the idea was, can we see any discernible difference in viral load given vaccination rate? And then can we use any of these, you know, trends that we see in viral load if we are getting detections to mobilize into these areas? And that's what's happened. So this is, we see kind of an immediate response from the city and the health department based on the data that we generate, which is a really, you know, I think useful and practical way to take these tools of wastewater surveillance. And so what's happened is when we've seen a spike in viral load at one of these catchments, the city has mobilized both vaccination and testing to that catchment. So this coming up this weekend will be the third time that that's happened. And they've even been able to work with the state to get any clinical testing, so swabs that they are able to do during these events, sent to the DCLS lab in Richmond to sequence, just to get an idea of the variant proportion in those. So that is a study that is, it will go at least one more week based on funding, but may get continued, and has been a really, I think, successful use of taking wastewater and using it to monitor out in a collection system and then actually responding based on the data. And so, you know, that was thought worth sharing with the group. But that's all the update I have. I'm happy to answer any questions with any remaining time for this item.
Relating to this slide that you have up, a question I've had is, you know, we've seen a spike here in the recent days, and what I've been reading most often is the D variants. Who is getting that? Is it catching it? Is it people who already have had COVID, or is it unvaccinated people? Can we tell?
Yeah, that's, I mean,
your
out of my realm, but I know that based on straight off a CDC site from just a week ago, nationally, the Delta variant accounts for 83% of the cases. And then, you know, another kind of stat that I brought is that upwards of 98% of the COVID deaths in the US are of the unvaccinated. Now, those two things don't exactly answer your question because I don't have a concise answer for it, but certainly the proportion of hospitalizations and deaths are largely of the unvaccinated portion of the population right now. And Delta is variant or is dominant, excuse me, once it makes its way into an area. And we've seen that in other countries where Delta has moved in, and then you do see a huge proportion of the cases made up by that strain specifically. So I think what there are out there right now are some mixed data on whether infections are more severe with Delta, but some pretty conclusive estimates on increased transmissibility based on just, I saw a 1,000x increase in viral load shed by a person with Delta. So, you know, three orders of magnitude greater viral load coming off of a person that is infected, meaning they will just be more contagious.
Thanks.
Kyle, listen, Commissioner Rodriguez, I'm wondering, do you have any idea with the information that Chesapeake has collected in collaboration with us, what they're doing with that information and how they're using our information?
Yeah, so we have a standing meeting on Friday to go over these data. And one of the ways they're using it is to mobilize these testing kind of response, testing and vaccination responses. I'm not sure if they are doing other analyses on them. You know, the data are pretty basic. You know, it's just once a week, five sites, and we give them, you know, what the concentrations are and then kind of help them with the interpretation and say, yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of way above our limit of detection. That's a pretty significant hit. Something I actually failed to mention, I'm glad you asked that question, is that this project is getting put, there's going to be an application for this Virginia Municipal League Innovation Award. So I think in the middle of this month, Dr. Anna Jang from ODU, because ODU has also been involved in this, is going to submit an application on behalf of all the groups that are collaborating on this project. So that's one other piece that I just actually failed to mention, and that one other place that the data is going. But other than that, and these responses to these pump station catchments where we see surges, I don't know of any other way they're using it right now.
Thanks.
Sure.
Okay, we thank you very much.
Great.
Going forward, then we move on to item 11, CID quarterly update. While they're getting set up, I think this is a good time to put a thank you in to you guys on the staff who put together this meeting. It's our first one where we're going in face-to-face type and with a electronic meeting as well. So, and it seems to be working quite well.
A few little bumps, but we'll get through it.
First one's always the hardest.
Go ahead now. Sir, you've got the...
Do you want to give Elizabeth a moment?
Face
I'm not seeing that. Higher, lower?
You look fine.
That's yeah, we can see you.
They take one step back.
Just back up. Just
okay.
Yeah, that's good, right?
Okay. All right. It's all right. We'll wing it. I'm ringing it. Okay. Got a couple of facts to share. All right. Good morning, everybody. Good to see everyone in person. Awesome. It's a great feeling. So today it's the end of the fiscal year, so I have a lot of data to share. Great opportunity to look back at the fiscal year and see how we did, and then have some information for you on how we're going to be moving forward in the coming year. So this fiscal year has been a real challenge for us, as you might guess, with COVID-19. many challenges. Our consultants and contractors have really had kind of one arm tied behind their back as they tried to implement our projects. But you look at the Woodstock Park project that was recently completed and the Water Quality Services building that you all will be touring here in a little bit, and really proud of the effort that our staff, our consultants, and our contractors have done to keep things moving forward. You talked to a lot of other utilities across the country. They either stopped their program or they greatly delayed their capital spending and their investment. And we've done neither. We've moved forward as fast as we possibly could, and we've just found ways to work around the challenges. So I'm really proud of the work that we've done in the past year. So I'll talk a little bit about, we've got close to our final spending numbers for the fiscal year on our CIP. Look at some of the performance metrics that we are focused on. Highlight the sewer rehab action plan, the project status there. We just had a major milestone on that effort. Staff, the commission has asked in the past about who the engineering firms and the contractors that we're using to implement these projects. So I'll be highlighting that issue, highlight some of the more significant projects that are driving our capital program, and then talk a little bit about our capital program and some of the challenges we're having right now on project cost variability. Everybody's hearing a lot about challenges with the workforce. If you go to a restaurant, you're going to wait longer to get your food. You order a new car, you're going to wait for it. Well, all those issues affect the construction industry in significant ways too. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So this is highlighting kind of the end of the year for fiscal year 2021. So we had 149 active projects in the fiscal year. So when you add up all the spending for all of those projects, this is the graphic that you'll see. So the blue line is what we plan to spend in the fiscal year, and the red line is what we actually spent on all those projects in the fiscal year. So we ended up spending about $212 million in this fiscal year. The largest year before that was last year, which was about $160 million. So we're almost $50 million more than last year. And in coming years, those numbers are going to be going up greatly, and I'll highlight that in a second. But we were at 90% of our planned spending. So in a year that we were challenged with COVID and some other constraints, it was a great year from a standpoint of meeting our targets. So I've highlighted kind of the six largest projects, and I've looked at those and said, how did we do on those six largest projects in the fiscal year? And try to figure out, are we spending, because usually the large projects drive our spending for the year. It's not that small, it's not the repair clamp project that matters on the CIP. It's, you know, we spend that in an afternoon at James River. So when you look at the largest six projects, that really drives our capital spending. So the first three projects, which is unusual, I don't think this has ever happened before, but the largest three projects for the fiscal year were all pipeline projects. And usually we have large plant projects or building projects that drive the large spending. But in this year, the largest three projects were pipe projects. And you can see the Surrey project is actually a little bit ahead of schedule from a spending standpoint, which is good. The Virginia Beach Boulevard was really almost on plan exactly within $200,000. And then the Hampton Trunk A&B was a little bit behind spending, about $2 million under what we planned to spend. That's been a very challenging project. That was the one where we had that line break. Very, very difficult project. Go to the second list. So these are the other three largest projects. The Providence Road is at Woodstock Park project. We spent almost exactly what we had planned because we finished the project in the fiscal year. So you kind of spend what you have left. The Water Quality Services building, we actually spent a little bit more than we planned when we originally estimated the project in the fiscal year. And then the Williamsburg switchgear project was the last project, and we were almost exactly on plan because that project's almost done too. So if you look at all of those six projects, we actually spent almost $2 million more than we planned to spend. So you might say, well, that's a bad thing, but actually in our project, that's a good thing. Most utilities struggle to implement capital programs. They underspend their program significantly. So when I see that we're actually spending a little bit more than we had planned, that means our contractors are getting the work done, we're making decisions, things are moving forward. So that's actually a good thing for us. Now, we can't have every project over budget, spending faster, but when you have a few projects, that's not a problem. And these are all very critical, large projects. So it's important that we stay on budget and schedule. So this shows a graphic for since 2008 through today. The red line is the planned expenditure for the fiscal year, and the blue line is what we actually spent. So you can see that line's going straight up, isn't it? And it's going to continue to go up in the coming years. So we hit about a 90% plan spend. That's actually really good. We've averaged in the last 5 years only 81% of what we plan to spend. So we were a little bit ahead of what we've done in the last 5 years. Last year we spent $161 million. So this year we were $212 million, significantly higher. Next year we're planning to spend $290 million. And then the year after that, $410 million. So we're in the big leagues with a lot of the other larger utilities across the country. So we're really at a very significant level. So it's really important that we are really doing the right things with these projects. Michael.
Bruce, congratulations. That's a great numbers. Do you think having more pipe projects versus plant projects help with the increased percentage of completion?
I'd say in this year, yes. The pipe projects are a little more straightforward, not always. Sometimes they are challenging from a real estate standpoint, but from a plant standpoint and from some of the issues in COVID, delays in getting materials on these larger complicated projects, I'd say so. So it's going to be challenging moving forward to stay on that 90% level. So we had 27 projects that we completed in the fiscal year. Can't read them all, I'm not asking you to, but the third one from the top is the Atlantic THP project, and that's the Canby project. That project grew in scope significantly. We originally appropriated about $40 million. We added $23 million to that project. That project significantly changed from when we originally planned it to when we actually finished the project out. That was by far the largest project from a standpoint of actual versus original. So the second to last column is the percentage of actual, what we actually spent versus our original budget when we first thought about it. And then the last column is what we actually spent against our final budget. So you can just go to the second slide here, Ted, this summarizes it. So if you look at all of those projects, if you just add them all up, if you look at what we initially appropriated versus what we actually spent, we spent about 32% more than what we initially planned. And you could say, well, that might be good, that might be bad. Really, that's in line with what we did last year. So all the projects that finished last year, we were at about 30% more, and this year we're at about 30%. So when you think about that graphic where we show, when you initially plan a project, you don't have any design done, you have just a concept, you have maybe a couple calculations, but really nothing in detail done. So when you look at all these projects and you add them all up, we spent about 30% more than that original thought. When you look at what we had appropriated when we were done versus what we finally spent, we were under budget by about 13%. So when we get closer to the end, we often have a little bit of cushion in our projects to make sure we have enough to finish them out. And some projects we never spend all the money that we originally intended. So that's how we end up at a minus 13%. But our process really allows for this flexibility. You know, if we wanted to add, I mean, I could add 30% to all of our projects. If you told me, hey, we don't want to have any additional appropriation on any project, well, I tell you, I'm going to add 32% to all of my projects up front. But when you look at what we actually spent, that minus 13%, we really wouldn't want to do that because then you're overly conservative on your budgeting. So we're always trying to balance coming up with the best estimate up front. Then as the project evolves, the scope changes, we actually appropriate different additional funds and we bring those to you as we go. But it's kind of a balancing act. We don't want to be too conservative, and then we don't want to be too kind of be on the other side and underestimate too much. So we're always in that balancing act. So on average, we're about 30% over from what we initially intended. So I don't think we want to change anything. I think our process works well, but that's just the fact of projects. They just grow in scope. And on average, our projects grow about 30%.
An initial appropriation has so little engineering in it at that point. Yeah.
It's just a concept at that point. And that's
how much of that is scope change versus, change of order change?
It's almost all scope change. I'd say two-thirds of it, 66%, is typically scope change. The other is either change field conditions or there's some errors and omissions or contractors messing up that we deal with that.
I'm curious how design build compares against a horror.
That's a good question. That's going on my slide next year. We don't have a lot of completed projects. I don't have those numbers for you right now, Steve, but I'll gladly get them for you. I think we've completed about 8 design build projects so far. We've got a bunch that are in the queue. And we've got the Woodstock Park project with design build, and the water quality services building was design build. the Surrey project will be design built. What we find is we rarely require additional appropriation. Actually, that's a great lead into my discussion on cost variability at the end here, because we're trying to figure out how to handle that issue.
Yes. Can you just go back to the previous page?
Sure.
That bottom of my screen keeps on coming in and out. The Suffolk, the two projects, the Suffolk, one at Shingle Creek, and then the one above it. Does that take care of that pump station on Shingle Creek?
Yeah, so Ted mentioned the fact that we were, by building the pump station, we wouldn't have to do some of the Shingle Creek improvements. Well, that's part of that project. So we didn't need to spend. You can see we actually spent only $1.2 million of the $9 million we had appropriated. So we didn't need to make all those improvements on that gravity sewer because of the pump stations we're building. So this project was greatly, you could say it was overfunded, but it was really, we reduced the scope significantly.
So the pump stations is that a process?
Yeah, these are projects that are completed. So the Shingle Creek portion of the project was done, and that's why it's showing up now. The Suffolk project's got a number of years still to go. Okay. And you'll see that in a future slide when we finish that one up. Sure. Okay, another one of our performance metrics. We look at how many projects that we actually complete in the fiscal year versus how many we plan to complete in the fiscal year. So in this year, we finished 27 projects. We actually plan to finish 41. So that was about a 66% completion rate. And that really doesn't sound that great. But when you look at past years, that first column, the percent complete by end of fiscal year, we range from 46% up to a high of about 75%. So about 18 months before the fiscal year starts, or 6 months before the fiscal year starts, we look at how many projects are we going to complete in that fiscal year. If we finish it July 2nd, it didn't get completed. So it's only those projects that we plan to complete in the fiscal year that we actually complete. So not completing projects is kind of a death knell of a CIP, because if it doesn't get completed, then you got to complete it in the next year, and you can't start the next project that's already in line because you didn't finish the last project. And it's this tidal wave of projects that you never quite finish, that you can't put project managers on because they still got old projects and they never quite get done. So it's really important to finish projects. And if you let them drag on, that last 5% takes, 90% of the time, right? So finishing projects, getting things off your list and getting to the next thing is really important for us. So we really look at this closely. So this is just a metric that we track. 66% is kind of on the average for the last 5 years. And I've got a next slide that highlights some of the reasons why we didn't get all these projects done. So I looked at the projects that didn't get completed in FY21, and I tried to figure out the best reason why they weren't done. So in the last fiscal year, construction-related delays were the number one reason by a significant amount. Last year, the number one reason was design-related delays. That was the number three reason this year. So we've seen different reasons in different years, and I think a lot of it has to do with what types of projects are in the CIP in that time frame. So if you have a lot of projects that are in the construction phase, ones that don't complete it end up on this list. Last year, there was a lot of projects that were in the design phase that this year were in the construction phase. So we have a lot of projects that were in the construction phase that did not get completed. The water quality services building is an example. We didn't take credit for that one. It didn't get completed. It was supposed to get completed by June 30th. It's now July 28th. It got done. I think we got the letter this week that we can move in. So it technically didn't get completed. So that's an example of a project that didn't get done. It was 99% done, but we didn't get that occupancy permit until in July. So we didn't take credit for it in the previous fiscal year. Kind of an example. Number of other reasons, some of the COVID-related reasons are delaying our projects. Kind of secondary reasons, there's supply chain issues, working with property owners on easement acquisitions, the city deeds and records, those processes are all really gummed up at this point. So those kind of create just challenges for us that delay projects as they work into the construction phase. Getting permits, a lot of the cities they're not going to show up in person now to even give you a sign up. You have to take a picture and send it to them, and then they eventually get back to you and sign off on your building permit. So there's just a lot of interesting things going on that just slowed down our projects, not significantly, but just a month here and a month there, and you're not done in the fiscal year.
Now, are we having the same project issues with doing pipe projects that are going into the ground? They're not showing up?
Not as much. You know, the I'll talk about the big three projects, the big pipe projects here. These are all actually on schedule. But we are seeing on some of our other projects that are more plant related and other building related.
There isn't as much city interface on inspection on these pipe projects.
Right.
It's not like a resident. Yeah. I mean, once we've got our permit, it's our inspector watching it, and the city doesn't really care what happens to our pipe.
But if we're tearing up a road, they still got to come out and evaluate that process, right?
Yeah. A lot of the supply chain issues on our plant projects with getting equipment, purchasing stuff, it's on a boat somewhere, generators, electrical equipment, those things are all back ordered, and they have been slowing down our projects.
But the pipe projects seem to be.
Pipe projects at this point are seeming to be to moving forward pretty nicely.
Now, do you think that's because we're a larger entity and they're more to cater to us versus a smaller?
I think it's, it's just not, once we get past the real estate issues, it's just not, there's not a lot of things that get in our way.
Right, that too.
Unlike a building over here, we've got mechanical, electrical, every different inspector, and everyone wants something different. The first visit, they say something, and the next guy that shows up wants something different.
The first sub that is, is back up, doesn't have has a COVID test, they're off the job, and just these things just tend to build on themselves on these vertical projects.
You don't have a lot of subs, you're just out there putting pipe in the ground. But you're right, the ones that big road crossings, Virginia Beach Boulevard, but even that stayed online.
Mm-hmm. So the three big projects, the pipeline projects, obviously this is a picture of the work out in Surrey, a very rural area. They can really plug and chug laying pipe out there. We're about, we're more than 50% of the pipe that's been installed. This is 25 miles of pipe. So they've laid about 50% of the pipe. Construction continues at four of the new pump stations. The MEB team is really in the construction phase now and is really doing well. They're telling us we're a little bit ahead of schedule at this point. So that's good. They're really doing well out there. As rural as that project is, we've got two very urban projects. This is the cleanup work on Virginia Beach Boulevard, phase six. This was another project that we hope to have done by July 1st. Looks like it's not going to be done until the third week in August at this point. We only have about 200 feet of pipe to lay on this project, but it's very tricky. It's part of right at the intersection of Great Neck Road and Virginia Beach Boulevard. There's a Starbucks there at the corner. We can only work on weekends from Friday at 7 p.m. till Sunday at 4 a.m. or whatever. So there's very limited windows that we can do this last bit of work. So the last pipe should go in by the third week in August here. And this is a critical project to the Cheslis closure. So we need to divert this flow heading to east to our Atlantic plant. So getting this last little bit of pipe in the ground is really important. But generally this project's gone well. We worked with the Lowe's shopping center, the Lowe's folks across the street, challenging project, but really things are moving quite well out there. And then the last of the three big projects, the Hampton Trunk A and B replacement, the contractor's making good progress out there. Another very tricky project in a challenging area. We've laid, how much more? We've laid about 6,000 of the 9,000 feet to go in. So we've laid, two thirds of the pipe to go in. We're planning to be complete next April, and we're slightly ahead of schedule there. We actually have put two small segments of this pipe online, and this was the pipe that we had that failure in last year. So, and a challenging project, deep project, large pipe, so in a busy area. Close to Ted's home, so he's out there always.
Makes it even more challenging.
There you go.
I go out and look at it every
we got an unpaid inspector out there on the job.
Just to add to the challenge.
So the rehab action plan, three phases, 0, 1, and 2. We've met the phase one deadline. That was May of 2021. A challenging, each phase, there's more projects. So phase zero was pretty straightforward. There were just two projects. Phase one, there was 13 projects. And then in phase two, there's a total of 38 projects. So with each phase, it gets more challenging. We jump through the hoop, and then there's a bigger hoop for us to jump through. So we met the phase one deadline. That was a big milestone for the group. And now we're into the middle of phase two. So the two small projects in phase zero are completed. All the projects in phase one are now complete. Those were the 13 projects, and there were three that hadn't been completed the last time we talked. So those are all completed at this point. So now we're in the middle of the phase two work. And that's our focus for the next 4 years till May of 2025. There are 38 projects in this list. And six projects have changed phase since we last met. So this is the first group of projects, and this is the second group of projects here. So this will be a very challenging effort to get these projects done in by May of 2025. And you might say, well, Bruce, why don't you just start? You should have started those earlier. Why don't you start them all? Because when we see here, some of them you can see are still listed as proposed. Some of them haven't even begun yet. Well, we have financial constraints. We can't start all the projects at one time. We also have resources that are limited from a standpoint of project managers and other things. So we have to balance these projects and, you know, place them out over time. So the end result is we're working to that deadline. We've got all these projects queued up, ready to go, and the projects that are more complicated, we started earlier, and those smaller projects were late, we're starting a little later, but we can't start all the projects early because of financial constraints and you know, internal resources. This graphic kind of highlights where we are. Phase zero and one are 100% done. We're the design phase and phase two, 63%. So most of the projects are in the design phase. A handful of projects are complete or in the construction phase, and about 21% of the projects have yet to begun, but they'll be starting in the next 6 months here. So we're well on our way on phase two and a very challenging list. So after that, I want to talk a little bit about some of the firms that are helping us and the value of the work that's involved here. So this first list is a list of all of the engineering firms that are helping us through annual services contracts. There are a total of 10 different annual services contracts. We use those for small projects, specialty studies, and sometimes even emergency work, or sometimes to supplement our needs internally. So these are firms that are helping us over a 5-year term. So there's three of those firms or SWAM firms, and you can see that the term is the second column or the fourth column in. That's the year of their term. So most of these are 5-year terms. So you can see 4 out of 5 is the fourth year of that term. The number of task orders are the active task orders that they're working on. And the last column is the value of all those tasks added up. You can see by this that HDR and Hazen and Sawyer have the largest volume of work with us at the moment. And they've been trusted consultants for us for many years. Second group is these are 19 engineering firms that are helping us on projects that we've awarded individually. So these tend to be larger projects, complicated projects that are awarded by an engineer selection process. So there's 19 different firms that hold contracts with us. Some of them hold multiple contracts. AECOM is by far the largest dollar value there, and they are helping us with our SWIFT program. So it's not surprising that the dollar value of their work is the largest out of any of the A&E firms that we're working with here. There's a couple of new firms on the list. Earth Data is on the list, VHB is on the list, and Tetra Tech are firms that are fairly new to our organization, but have been doing a great job for us. And we'll be working with more new firms as our capital program continues to grow. We'll be working with firms that we've not had experiences with in the past. We also have annual services contracts for construction. So those are typically for pipeline related work. And we have two contractors that are helping us with those efforts, Bridgman Civil and Tidewater Utility. They help us, those are limited in the dollar value, but they're typically interceptor sewer pipe projects, small dollar value projects, and projects that are hard to define in a scope that they'll help us with, like that clamp project would be a great project to assign to one of these firms, because it's really hard to estimate the value of some of these projects until you really get into them. So on smaller projects and on projects that are difficult to estimate, these firms are very helpful. We also use these firms very often in emergency projects too, because we've already negotiated rates with these firms, and we have a trust level with them, so we can quickly put them on jobs. And they've stepped up. I cannot tell you how many times Bridgman Civil has stepped up in the middle of the night, 2 a.m, and is out there helping us on a project, helping to figure it out. You know, these are design build, you know, 2 a.m. with, envelope on the back of a piece of paper trying to figure out what to do. And they're very willing to suggest ideas and work with us. So we're very thankful to have these two firms to help us in those types of unusual situations. And then finally, these are all the contractors that we've awarded contracts to. I meant to say the engineering firm, that first list that I showed you, there's only one firm, I think it was Earth Tech, that's a SWAM firm. So most of the engineering firms are national engineering firms, so very few of those are SWAM, but a lot of the subconsultants that they use are SWAMP firms. So their geotech, their survey, their specialty needs are oftentimes done by SWAMP firms, but the large A&E firms typically are not SWAMP firms. So these are all construction contracts, a lot of different firms we're working with. I believe there's 18 different contractors that we've awarded contracts to. Some of those contractors have many contracts with us. As you can see, many of them are SWAMP firms. A lot of them hire SWAMP firms as subcontractors on those contracts. Alleman Schutte Alberisi has the largest dollar value there. That's the James River Swift program, so it's not surprising that they have the largest dollar value. MEB is second largest. They have a lot of work with us too and have been a trusted contractor to work with over the years. So I want to talk quickly here in closing on capital project cost variability. Y'all have heard about this in the news. If anybody's tried to replace a deck on the back with buying plywood or anything like that, everybody knows some of the challenges. You try to buy a car, even a used car right now, it's prices are, you know, skyrocketed. So some of the challenges that we're facing on our, you face at home, we face on our projects. So cost escalation is a big issue for us. Prices are all over the place right now. And supply chain issues cause delays. You know, a pipe supplier or someone else will make a promise to the contractor at bid date. And guess what? It's not ready at time, but it's very hard for our contractors to pick someone else because everybody has some of the same supply chain delays. So we're all counting on other people to deliver things. A lot of things got closed when COVID started. So things are trying to ramp back up. But a lot of the stuff, whether it's specialty equipment, switchgear, electrical equipment, high dollar value components, they're just not there. They're not available. So it's a challenge for us when supply chain delays hit us. So a lot of our contractors are busy right now. It's a good time to be a contractor. So they have a nice backlog. So when you have a nice backlog, you're not really given great competitive prices. You're not sharpening your pencil too close. When you've got a comfortable backlog, you might give a bid on a price on a project, but you're not given that low, low price. You're putting a nice comfortable profit in that project because you've got a nice backlog of work already. So we're seeing with contractors having more backlog, you see fewer contractors bidding work, and then the prices that they're bidding are higher. So that's a challenge for us when we've got a very aggressive capital program. Our consultants and contractors are all challenged with limited workforce and staffing. Everybody's hiring right now, particularly people with skills. A lot of folks are hiring younger folks out of college on the consulting side, but it takes years to get that experience you need to be, you know, highly productive. Our contractors are seeing the same issue. A lot of the folks are poaching from different firms. We just lost one of our project managers to our consultant. We're obviously trying to grab some of the folks on the consulting side to come to work for us. So it kind of goes both ways there. On the contracting side, you know, they're skilled trades. They are paying a premium and they are having a real hard time finding people. And when they don't have the staff, they're not bidding on new work. So this, it's just kind of a cycle right now, a vicious cycle of a challenging time in the contracting community. But they're catching up. For the last few years, it's been kind of tight and they've not made the profit margins that they can make now. So it's kind of that pendulum's kind of sliding to their side. So it's important that we're a owner that people want to work for. That's another thing they look for. They want to work for a contractor with an owner that they can make a profit and they can feel that we'll be treating them fairly. They can be more choosy at this point. Before they couldn't be as choosy because there wasn't as much work out there. Now they can be a lot more choosy. And then, go ahead, Steve.
Are we doing anything about cost escalation on projects that were already bid in the pipeline?
We've seen a few cases, you know, we get lump sum prices. So the contractors are really locked into their price. We've had a couple of suppliers that have issued force majeure letters to us, which are saying, you know, it's outside of our control. We can't get our materials. The copper price has gone up. We can't control this. This isn't a reasonable, you know, cost escalation. This is a force majeure letter, but it's not as much on the pricing side. Our contractors haven't hit us on that. They're hitting us on delays. So the supplier, Ferguson, whoever will send us, you know, force majeure letter saying, we can't get you this stuff when we promised you. And we can't control that. So the contractor can't go back on them and try to get liquidated damages passed back to the supplier because they've issued these force majeure letters. So it's more on the scheduling than on the pricing, but on new prod, what the contractors do, they can't make it up on the project that they're doing today, but they're going to surely make it up on the next job. So that drives pricing up even more, because if you lost money on the last job because the copper price went up, that's not going to happen to you on the next job.
Yeah, one of your slides you're going to talk here at the end about a creative solution.
Kind of a creative solution there. So, and we are seeing increase. So some of the cities and counties, you know, when their tax base had been in question, they put a lot of their capital projects on hold. Well, now everybody's starting to get their work started again. So there's just more projects being bid. So with more projects being bid and less contractors available, you know, that supply and demand starts going in the opposite direction. So there's more owners bidding work at this point. And that Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, that $3 billion project down the street, impacts everybody. I mean, you might not think so, but they've got carpenters, they've got, you know, they're pouring concrete, they've got steel, they've got everything that we have on our projects just going on out there. Every bridge, every crane in Hampton Roads is probably sitting out there. If you drive by, if you came from the peninsula today, you saw some of those cranes. So that affects everybody. That's and skilled trades. I mean, they're going to go where they can make the most money. So that's a challenge for us. So a little bit on the ENR, Engineering News Record, is one of the industry standards that we look at. They have cost indexes that they've had since 1919. So the construction cost index right now, it's at a 5.9% annual increase. The building cost index, the BCI, is at 10%. Those have been averaging 2-3% for the last 5 years or so. So you can see they've gone up significantly. We typically watch that construction cost index, and that one's typically more labor, more percentage of the labor is into that index, which is the types of work that we do. The building cost index is more for vertical construction projects. So we're usually marking ourselves against that construction cost index, but we ramped our capital program by 3% in the last year. And now we're seeing 5.9% increases on that on an average. And the material cost index is averaged across the board at 4.6%. But there's been great variability in steel and copper and aluminum and lumber. So those things are all over the place. So at bid day, the contractors, you know, on a big job that lasts many years, they're going to have to guess what lumber price is going to be 3 years from now. And that's a challenge. And they can't be too high. They can't just say, well, lumber is going to triple in price, so I'm just going to put all this extra money in my bid because they won't get any work. But if they bid too low, they're going to get stuck. So it's this, and Steve knows the issue, you've got to find that reasonable sweet spot. And we don't want contractors bidding low and then hitting us with a force majeure letter and wanting more money. And on the other hand, if they just bid high, they're never going to get any work. So it's a tough time to be a contractor from that standpoint when they're bidding now and having to estimate what things are going to be like in the future. And our design build projects really are a challenge, because what we do on our projects is we hired a design build team and we ask for a price before the design's even done. So, and the price and the selection is partially based on the price that they give up front. So that construction cost limit, or CCL, can be between 20 and 40% of the selection. And they have to give us the price before the design's even completed. And so it takes 6 to 12 months to finish the design. And then they give us a final stipulated price at the end of that point. And then that's the final price. But typically, the only reason we allow them to vary from the construction cost limit, contract cost limit, to the stipulated price is if there's been a scope change from initial, or there's been some unforeseen condition that we can say, yeah, that's truly, you could have never anticipated that. They just can't say, well, prices have gone up, so we want an extra 25% on the project. We wouldn't allow that to happen. So they're having to estimate upfront how to price some of these things. And if they price it too high, they're never going to get selected. And if they price it too low, they're going to be holding the bag at the end. So in design build, it's even trickier, because in a hard bid, they're ready to start construction right after the award. In design build, they're giving us a price before the design is even done. So they got to carry their price even longer. So our process in a market where there's a lot of variation in materials is a big challenge for contractors. So what we've done on one project, on our Eastern Shore project, which we just talked about today, we try to balance that. So we don't want contractors putting in real high prices. That doesn't help us. And we don't want them putting in real low prices and then trying to hit us with a force majeure letter saying, well, that's not our problem. It's your problem now, Mr. Hunter. So we're trying to balance that risk. So what we did was on that project, 25% of the selection was based on price. It's 22 miles of 6-inch and 8-inch HDPE pipe. So almost all the project is in the pipe. lot of our plant projects, there's 1,000 different things. But in this project, it's almost all HDP pipe. And there has been a lot of variation in plastic pipe in recent months. So what we did was with all the teams that were shortlisted, each of those three teams that got shortlisted, they gave us a quote for their pipe at the time of selection. And when they give us the final stipulated price, which is in 6 months or so, they're going to give us a new quote. And if that quote is more than 10% difference, we'll split the difference with them 50%. Now, if it's lower, we get this 50% of the savings. Probably not going to be lower. But if it's more than 10% higher, we'll share that difference with them and kind of share that risk a little bit so that they don't put in an arbitrarily high price into this process, which, you know, I'm hoping that might have saved us a little bit. You saw that the price was pretty competitive that we got.
So are we splitting anything above 10%?
Yes.
So if it was 12%, we'd only split 2%.
Yes. Yeah. We're just trying to protect them against a huge price swing. Now, our other projects aren't that easy because there's thousands of components and we really don't want to get quotes for 10,000 things and then be going through that. So some of our other projects, we're hoping that the economy is going to calm down a bit from the fluctuation on material pricing. That's all I had for you this morning. Welcome to answer any questions that y'all might have.
We had two big easement projects, you know, Virginia Beach and Surrey.
Right.
Where do we stand on all those easements? I know we were getting close.
Well, we've finished the Virginia Beach Boulevard one. Is done.
All done.
All done. Yeah, we've negotiated. Lowe's came to terms with us, so that's all done. Surrey, I think we might have one or two easements that are outstanding. We have a couple of easements we could not acquire. And we've done a take. But we're still negotiating with them. We haven't got to the condemnation point yet. We started that process on a couple of them because there were some unclear titles on some of those properties. And I think I just saw a letter just last week where we've got someone who's not happy with our take. So they filed a counter suit to our take. So they're trying to untake our take. And I'm not a lawyer here, It's a challenge. I think that's kind of a challenging issue to unfold. Middlesex is another huge project for us, and there's a ton of easements there. And there's a bunch of easements on the Eastern Shore project that we're working through. So our real estate folks are super busy right now.
Congratulations on those two I mentioned. Those were huge numbers for all of us on the commission.
Yep.
That's probably the biggest that we've ever encountered.
Are those issues that are on the Surrey line, are they holding up crossing the property, or are we just going ahead crossing the property and wiping it out?
Well, there's 20 miles of pipe, so we're not working in areas where we don't have clear title. Okay. So we have a take, we have the right to be there, or we have an easement. But so there's a handful of properties that are still haven't been closed from a standpoint of negotiating a final deal. And we really don't want to be on their property if we can help it while we're still negotiating. That's really not really acting in good faith.
I was just wondering if they needed
Kevlar
vest.
Yeah. There's a lot of shotguns out there. Yeah.
Be careful. So far, so good.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. But we've got enough area to work. You know, we've got another year or so to work through those easements, and Ayanna's working hard to work through those and get to a final settlement there. Thank you.
Thank you. Reporters.
Okay. No other questions. And we go on to the unfinished business.
None that we're aware of.
How about new business?
Don't have any of that either.
Commissioner comments.
I think we're all good.
I might say we have a, describe, Moe is here. Former commissioner just came in and said, welcome. And public comments, nobody was registered. So informational items, let's see, we've got, were there any questions on the various reports that were at the bottom of our report? So then the next commission meeting will be an in-person one again. on August 24 at the HRSD South Shore Operations Complex. If there's no other business, we are adjourned to go to